Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Greetings and welcome to another episode of Animal Instinct here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Celia Kutcher, also known as the Food Healer, and today we've got a serious topic. We're going to be talking about cancer with Dr. Britton. So, you know, we'll have a happier ones coming up, but this is a really important topic. So if you do have a pet, please stay tuned and pay attention because this is a lot of information and it's really serious and it's pretty current and there's a lot of this stuff happening right now. So that being said, Dr. Brooke Britton, hello, how are you?
Hello, I'm good. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you so much for coming to Roberta's and doing this.
It's my pleasure.
It's a crowded day in the restaurant today, so see if we can get some food later. So let's start really, really basics. You're an oncologist at Blue Pearl Vet, specialty in emergency medicine for pets.
Yes.
So what is oncology?
Oncology is the science of cancer medicine. So we treat cancer specifically in small animals, or I treat cancer in small animals, so mainly cats and dogs.
Okay. And what's the most common form of cancer you're seeing these days?
For cats, I would say lymphoma,
really?
Which is an immune system cancer. And for dogs, lymphoma as well as some skin cancers.
Why do you think you're seeing skin cancers in dogs?
Skin cancers in dogs are fairly common. A lot of genetic breed predispositions. Flat-faced dogs, allergic dogs in particular, tend to develop skin cancers.
Interesting.
A lot of times, unfortunately, we don't always know the reason why dogs and cats develop cancer.
Yeah.
But there are some environmental factors as well that can play into things.
Your timing is perfect. I was just about to ask you, what are the what do you think about environmental factors having to do with cancer in animals?
There are a lot of different theories about environmental factors that come into play. We know that there are some environmental factors that are shared with humans. Tobacco smoke is a big one.
Really?
In cats in particular, that can predispose to head and neck cancers and intestinal cancers, such as carcinomas. Lymphomas as well. And we know that certain factors such as obesity can play into cancers, bladder cancers in dogs, for example. There are probably a lot of other environmental factors that come into play that we don't have definitive links. But, you know, urban environment is always a factor, or at least implicated, we think. But there's not definitive proof for urban environment. Other epigenetic factors probably come into play, too.
Yeah, like, I mean, I don't know if you know this information or not, but is it, are there more animals with cancer in urban environments than, like, out in the sticks or in the country?
I would say that there's probably a higher incidence of certain types of cancer in urban environments. We certainly see our fair share of cancer patients in urban environments. So I think a lot more of the immune system cancers tend to be seen in urban environments. When I talk with my colleagues that practice in more rural areas, that see small animals. So I think so.
It's interesting. I mean, and then there's also things like, you know, pesticides and funky chemicals, and there was that whole thing that I don't even know what the truth is about Febreze. There was this whole thing that Febreze kills animals, don't use it around animals, it causes cancers, blah, blah, blah. I don't know if that was ever proven or not, but even things as simple as that, air fresheners, you know, those sort of things.
Very true. Well, we know that some lawn chemicals, for example, back in the day, DDT, for example, was implicated in certain bladder cancers, certain old products in flea collars. Now the and older flea and tick products, now newer products like Frontline, for example, are not thought to be involved in or have not been implicated in the development of those cancers, but certainly several decades ago that was the case.
Wow. It's really scary when you think about it.
Absolutely.
You know? And so, okay, let's say you have a client who comes in, and I know it's different for dog and cat. However, can we pretend there's like a dog-cat thing for this? There might not. It might be too. It depends. But so someone comes in with their pet. It's not acting correctly. They do all the diagnoses and all this, and it turns out that the animal has cancer. What's the usual first step in protocol?
In terms of moving forward for treatment or...
I guess, yeah, like, you know, the first thing would be like your pet has cancer. So then my question would be like, well, what are the options?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess does it start very specifically, or is it just, you know, there's 100 million options depending on what cancer it is kind of thing?
Well, that's actually it's a broad-based question, but it's a good question because there are oftentimes many different options when mm-hmm. there's a diagnosis of cancer. And I think the important difference between oncology and human medicine and oncology and veterinary medicine is understanding that we have to present the options very differently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in human medicine, when a patient's diagnosed with a cancer, there is often a preference on the part of the oncologist. Maybe there are options presented, but mm-hmm. there is often a treatment plan that is, this is how we're going to treat. With us, there are many other factors that come into play,
mm-hmm.
whether it's financial factors, mm-hmm. maybe people do or do not have insurance. There are financial factors that come into play. There are factors such as how proactive or not proactive, how conservative, how aggressive people mm-hmm. want to be. You know, maybe people want to incorporate certain holistic treatments into a treatment protocol versus more traditional / Western medicine. So there are many different factors that we have to think about when we're presenting options, and we have to be sensitive to the considerations of people when they're thinking about how they want to go forward treating their cat or their dog or, you know, other species, if we're treating other species. So we present options, and then we also have to think about not only what are all the available options, which we are obligated to present, but what also makes sense for that patient specifically.
Yeah.
You know, maybe there are other health concerns in that patient. Maybe the age of that patient comes into play, or, you know, we don't necessarily, maybe some of those options aren't in the best interest of that patient, even though technically they're an option of treatment for that particular disease. So, you know, it's a very complex issue, and we have to parse out what we think are individually amongst those options, you know, the best treatment plans. Mm-hmm. And then amongst those plans, then we choose together as the treatment team. And it really is a team effort between the oncologist, the primary veterinarian, and the owner, client, parent.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
To speak.
And I think that's a really good point, too, because it's, you know, human medicine is all about save that patient, no matter what it takes, keep them alive. And in some cases, that's not the best option, you know, and with animals, it's a different thing. So
it is very different. And a lot of times what I stress is, you know, not that quality of life is not a concern in human medicine. It very much is a concern. But I think for us, you know, we have a lot more ethically murky issues because we are making choices for living beings that cannot make choices actively for themselves.
That's a great point.
When we are dealing with their medical care. And
really
so, you know, they have perhaps a chronic cancer or maybe a terminal cancer
mm-hmm.
where they may require treatment to improve their quality of life, or we may recommend a treatment. And then you have the feelings of the person who is their caretaker in life.
Yeah.
You may have the individual patient's feelings who, unfortunately, unless we're mind readers, we don't really know all of the individual feelings that the patient may have. We can maybe surmise, but it's very difficult for us to know how they feel. And then we have, you know, our responsibility to do what we think is in their best interest.
Yeah.
And so it can become a very complex issue, and trying to guide people through those decisions and that decision-making process mm-hmm. can be difficult.
I'm sure it's got to be really difficult. And it's also, you know, just the emotional aspect, too, from owners and everybody involved. You know, I'm sure it's a very... Yeah, after working in a vet and not dealing with things nearly as intense as cancer and just the reactions. And, I mean, I'm an awful pet owner when I go to the vet. I'm like a wreck. It's like, oh, my God, it's all, you know, it's been like a broken nail. And I'm like, they're crippled, you know, so.
This is why I have a general practitioner friend of mine who looks after my own French bulldog. I have a French bulldog. And she examines my French bulldog because I don't think I can be objective with him.
That's funny.
And I'm also a little bit further removed from the general practice side, having been a specialist for a few years now. But it is true. It's very hard to be objective when you're personally invested and emotionally invested. And it is difficult. And they also, I think, look at things very differently than we do. I mean, if we have a cancer diagnosis or a disease diagnosis, we look at down the line, you know, 6, 12, 18 months or years down the line, what about our friends, our family? How are we going to get our affairs in order? How is this going to affect our life? Yeah. And, you know, for them, I don't think, at least, that they think in that same way.
Yeah.
You know, they have more simple pleasures. They're thinking about their more immediate day-to-day, spending time with their family, and those more immediate, simpler pleasures of their day-to-day. And so I view it as my responsibility to present their people and their caretakers with all of the options that I think are reasonable at the time, to help them make an informed decision, take the struggle and the agita and the strife out of making that decision, and to the extent that I can, you know, as much as possible, and also to improve that quality of life to the highest extent that I can for as long as I can without going through, you know, extreme heroics or something that I think is prolonging the inevitable or, you know, making it, you know, well past the point where I'm actually doing any help or anything like that. And I think as long as we keep those types of thoughts and concerns at the forefront of our mind, you know, we can't make a wrong decision.
Yeah.
You know, we're always making a right decision by them. But it's definitely a different type of experience doing oncology in the veterinary sphere than human. Not that I've ever practiced as a human oncologist. Never been an MD, but I have some MD friends, and you know, I think it's a different experience.
It really is. I mean, it's a totally different thing, and they're both, you know, it's incredibly important as well. And what you're saying, I really, really respect, and I really appreciate it, because, you know, when an animal is so sick that it's on its way out, and then just fight, you know, and the poor thing doesn't have fight left, and it just becomes, I don't like this word, but for lack of a better word, I feel like at that point it almost becomes almost like torturous for the animal, you know?
Yeah, well, and that speaks to a pretty common conception and misconception that people have, and this is a, you know, somewhat depressing but important topic to address, I think, which is euthanasia.
Totally.
It's something that we have the ability to do in veterinary medicine as a whole and in oncology specifically. That is a very thorny issue, but it's a very prescient issue. And I think in oncology, patients specifically, is something that when we perform that service, and I do see it as a service, you know, it is at a point where we are ending that suffering and we are making that active choice. And everyone has a different belief system. And, you know, I don't impose my beliefs on other people and I don't push people into that decision. But I do view it as something that we, you know, offer as, it's a mixed blessing.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's a mixed blessing. And, you know, I'm glad that we have the ability to do it in some cases where we're offering that before things get to the bitter end, where there is true suffering, and we know that we can't return them ever back to their former their former state, their former quality.
Yeah, totally.
And we avoid that, you know, hospice scenario where the lingering happens. You know, but it's a different belief and a different path for everyone.
Yeah.
And it's a different choice. And it's not for me to judge.
Exactly.
You know, for me, I view myself as the guide that helps people through these decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because it's not unlike a therapist role in some regards. And it's not training that we necessarily receive in veterinary school. So it's in residency training. So it's a very interesting pathway to walk if you go into this specialty, because, you know, a lot of situations require those types of skills, and you learn how to do it or not along the way, depending upon your personality and your willingness to Totally. You know, to do that.
Yeah, to be able to do it all. Because that's hard, too.
It is. But it really, you meet some phenomenal people along the way and learn how much people really care and mm-hmm. how giving the human spirit is. And that's part of what I love about my job.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
My patients are wonderful, but, you know, part of what makes my job so wonderful, too, is working with the people that come along with my patients.
Cool. That's really cool. Well, we need to take a quick station break. So I am talking to Dr. Brooke Britton. We're talking about cancer in animals. We're going to take about a minute and a half. We'll be back to continue the conversation.
You are listening to It's Cold and Beautiful by Magical Mistakes. This is Animal Instinct on heritageradionetwork.org. We'll be right back.
Hello out there, it's Steve Jenkins, I'm with Fairway Markets. White Leghorn, Red Wattle, Bourbon Red, Navajo Churro. Well, these aren't names you're likely to hear at a Fairway butcher counter or any other counter today, but before the rise of factory farming, you would have. And at Heritage Foods USA, you still do. Heritage Foods USA exists to promote genetic diversity, small family farms, and a fully traceable food supply. You see, we believe the best way to help a family farmer is to buy from them. And Heritage Foods is honored to represent a network of family farmers and artisanal producers whose work presents an immeasurable gift to our food system and to biodiversity. The meat we celebrate, whether it's heritage turkey, Japanese steaks, Berkshire pork, or Navajo churro lamb chops, is the righteous kind from healthy animals of sound genetics that have been treated humanely and allowed to pursue their natural instincts. It's a simple fact. Animals raised according to this philosophy taste better. And as we like to say, you have to eat them to save them. Visit us at heritagefoodsusa.com for more information.
And we are back. I am talking to Dr. Brooke Britton, and we're talking all about cancer, basically in domestic animals. So, Dr. Brooke, question for you. Like, we're talking about all this, like, final ends and stuff, but there are success rates. There's a lot of success. So let's talk about that and bring this up a little bit more.
Absolutely. Let's get on to the positive stuff.
Totally. So, what are your success rates approximately? Like, is there something? I know it's such an, this is the worst question ever because it's an individual case study
thing. Pretty broad based question.
Like, how many rainbows and unicorns do you see in a week? Since you've been in oncology, are you seeing an increase of survival rate, of survival or surviving?
There are some cancers that we have a stubborn ceiling with, mm-hmm. and a lot of those happen to be the immune system cancers like lymphoma, where we have some pretty stubborn survival statistics. We have initial very high response rates, particularly in dogs, and slightly lower in cats, but still promising. Lymphoma, for example, one of the most treatable cancers that we have, mm-hmm. and as well as one of the most common cancers that we see. And we have some newer therapies that are out that are hopefully going to push those survival rates longer and higher, which have to do with some therapies that are coming over from the human side. You know, drug development is a little bit slower for us because of the money that's involved mm-hmm. and the studies and the fact that we have less money, fewer patients on our side compared with the human side. So the gears grind a little bit more slowly on the veterinary medicine side. Mm-hmm. But in general, you know, the best survival rates are usually the cancers that we can remove surgically. Mm-hmm. And then if we need medical therapies like chemotherapy, or if, you know, we can combine surgery with radiation therapy if it's needed, which is another local therapy, mm-hmm. multi-modality treatments, those are often associated with the highest cure rates. And so there are a lot of, you know, or many curable cancers if we can incorporate appropriate surgery for a lot of the skin tumors that are lower grade, for example.
Yeah.
A lot of the systemic or metastatic cancers, we may be able to keep at bay for a while with our therapies. And again, it's also not so much about keeping at bay, although that's part of it, but the quality of life has to be a consideration.
Totally.
So keeping things slowly progressive or stable or, you know, partially responsive, but also with high quality.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the more promising treatments are for cancers that are, you know, tumors that we can incorporate surgery or get to early. And that kind of speaks to screening, regular veterinary visits to check for lumps and bumps, catching things when they're small, catching things when, and not kind of saying, okay, well, here's a lump that we noticed and let's just wait and see, or, looks, you know, it doesn't look like anything. Let's just wait and see if it grows or if something happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same as in human medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Screening and making sure that we're getting them in for regular visits to their primary veterinarian.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my goal is, while I love doing what I do and I love my patients and my clients, I hope that they never need me.
Totally.
And so, you know, it's always a bit sad when I see someone who said, well, you know, I first noticed this lump when it was the size of a pencil eraser 10 months ago, and now it's the size of a basketball hanging off, you know, my dog's side or whatever. So, you know, a lot of times when things are caught small and they're addressed when they're small or at least investigated then, you know, and some people like to follow up and some people don't at that point, but at least, you know, then they're kind of making a more active choice as opposed to someone telling them, don't worry about it, don't worry about it. Or, you know, letting it get to a point where our options are very much limited. So, you know, sometimes things are more silent killers. And a lot of cats, I think, unfortunately, we have that issue, you know, or we have things like inflammatory bowel disease in cats where we're struggling with these problems for months to years, and then they can turn into conditions. We think that inflammatory bowel is a continuum with lymphoma. So, you know, we have some conditions where, you know, cats and dogs can hide illnesses because that's instinctual for them, where things are more internal and they grow. And so it's, you know, not everything is going to present itself on the body. And I think, unfortunately, you know, in those cases, despite everything that you do and bringing your dog and cat to regular vet visits, you know, we still sometimes find these things later. But screening is very important as well.
So for like a, you know, go in with my pet for an annual checkup and they draw blood and stuff like that, will that simple blood test at least give some indicators that there might be something wrong?
What a wonderful question. Lots of people ask me that question. And unfortunately, normal blood work does not always mean that everything is all clear.
Okay.
So a lot of cancer patients have normal or nearly normal blood work.
Wow.
But there can be some indicators that something is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, high blood calcium, for example, is sometimes a big red flag for certain cancers. You know, changes in white blood cell or red blood cell counts or platelet counts. Organ dysfunction like liver or kidney values being out of whack. And those are fairly nonspecific changes. Lots of different disease conditions that are infectious or inflammatory or organ dysfunction can cause those types of changes. But, you know, again, getting, like you said, the pet in for regular screening, you know, those things can be picked up. And it's better when these things are found incidentally before the pet is feeling ill.
Yeah.
And then we go looking rather than the pet comes in because they're sick from these problems.
Totally.
Oftentimes when we find the things incidentally, we can do more about them than when they're sick from the problem, but not always.
And I don't know if this is right or not. I was told this all the time, but I want to hear it from you. Does cancer in animals manifest quicker than it does in human beings? Or like the tumors grow quicker, like does it spread faster?
Not necessarily growing faster or manifest more quickly, but I think that disease progression, cancer progression in dogs and cats is accelerated. When we talk about survival times in dogs and cats with cancer, we often talk about 1 and 2 year median survivals instead of 5 and 10 year like you do in people. And that makes sense because their lifespans are so much shorter than ours. But in general, cancers are much more progressed. And the time frames are more accelerated in dogs and cats. And part of what makes them such a wonderful model, dogs in particular, for studying cancer and making these comparisons between cancers in dogs in particular and people, and why a lot of vets are wanting to work with and are working with MDs more often now and doing comparative studies, is because a lot of not inducing cancer in dogs and cats, but really spontaneous models are there in dogs and cats already. They develop independent cancers because of all the same genetic and environmental, potential environmental factors like people do.
Wow.
And so a lot of these cancers are very similar and they behave very similarly and they are accelerated in how they develop and progress. And so the studies are, you know, are there. And so there are a lot of different consortiums and conferences now, and MDs and vets are starting to work together to think, how can we, you know, how can we look at this and maybe help help developments in human cancer as well from looking at dogs in particular, because they're a little bit more similar to people. And the melanoma vaccine is one very good example of collaboration between a veterinary team and a human medical team.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
So is cancer really more of like a disease for mammals?
Cancers can develop in really any species.
Okay.
But I think that, you know, well, it gets a lot of attention in mammals because...
Because we're mammals, so right. We need to know this stuff.
mutation can happen and cause cancer in any species, and it only takes one cell to go bad.
And then are there any forms of cancer that'll just kind of like encapsulate? So like if it comes in and you're like, if we don't touch it, everything will be fine. If we go after it, it's going to just explode and be a problem.
Not that I can think of right off the bat. You know, there are some cancers that are a little bit tricky if you manipulate them, and that can seed, so to speak. And carcinomas in particularly come to mind, which are cancers that come from the lining of things like skin or body cavities or organs. And when you surgically manipulate them, they can implant more readily on surfaces and become more difficult to deal with and spread by implantation. But in general, you know, messing with a cancer by touching it or interfering is not a reason not to address it. And I think that's one of the common fears, is that, well, you know, if it's a cancer, we should just leave it alone because it'll make it worse. You know, again, dealing with these things when they're smaller and less extensive is always more helpful than waiting and seeing what happens.
That usually makes so much sense. I mean,
usually that limits our options. If we wait and see.
Then it makes total sense, because it's, you know, if it's a little small, then even, you know, if it's skin cancer, it's a little tiny thing. I mean, it's an easy surgery, and you come in and it's, you know, 4-inch square, and now you're looking at skin grafts and all kinds of other problems that are going to form with this. So it really does make a lot of sense. So this is fascinating to me, actually. I saw that you specialize in cancers of the lung. Are there a lot of different kinds of cancers in the lungs for animals?
So I actually, on my bio, I write that I'm interested in cancer of the lung. We don't subspecialize the way that MDs do.
Okay.
So my particular interest is cancers of the lung and hematologic cancers like lymphoma, for example, immune system cancers. And that's what I did a lot of study and a lot of particular treatment in my residency training. So I'll just clarify that just in case people think I'm a lung specialist. I'm not a lung specialist per se. But there are lots of different cancers of the lung.
I'm shocked.
Lots of different cancers that can arise within and around the lung.
Wow.
But, yeah, any cell that lives within or around the lung tissue can become cancerous. So that can be the lung tissue itself, which can develop into a carcinoma, and there are many different subtypes. It can be the connective tissue elements, which can develop into sarcomas, connective tissue tumors. Immune system cancers can develop there. So there are a lot of different a lot of different tumors.
And are there certain breeds that are more prone to lung cancers of the lung?
Yes. So there are breed predispositions in all different types of cancers. Absolutely.
So if you were to go out and buy a pet tomorrow, would you get a mutt or would you get a purebred?
Well, that's a good point. There is that theory of hybrid vigor.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard the phrase, but hybrid vigor is sort of, you know, if you go out and adopt or purchase a mutt, that they are more hardy mm-hmm. against certain diseases and cancers. And I'm a huge proponent of getting a dog or a cat from a shelter or yeah. adoption or rescue. So I'm in full support of that in general, not just for the anti-cancer benefit.
Right, right.
but not necessarily, you know. Okay. Purebred dogs in general are more predisposed to certain cancers, but mixed breed dogs can certainly develop cancers. We see all types of cancers in pure and mixed breed dogs. So mutts don't necessarily escape cancer, unfortunately. It is the great equalizer, and it does not discriminate.
It's something that I've worked with cancer more with people, you know, and for me, when I was studying it, it's kind of like almost like a space alien, because it gets pissed off, it'll hide, it'll think it'll be gone, everything's good, and then all of a sudden, hey, I'm over here. You know, I feel like it almost has a mind of its own. It's really, if you can take all the personal stuff out of it and just look at it as what it is, I mean, it's fascinating how progressive this is and how smart it is, really.
It is extremely intelligent and adaptive, and I don't know if you've ever heard of or read the book, The Emperor of All Maladies,
no.
which is about cancer. It's an MD wrote the book and his experience as an oncologist. It's a fascinating book, and it really is The Emperor of All Maladies.
Wow.
And it's why so many people are interested in cancer biology, and it's why so much money is invested mm-hmm. in cancer drug development and pharmaceuticals, and it's why you know, so much interest is poured into it, because so many people die of it, so many animals die of it. And it's, you know, the biology of it is fascinating, and we will never beat it because it is so adaptive and because it's so intelligent. But at the same time, we can keep trying, and
yeah.
we can keep developing, and we are adapting as it adapts.
And
but it is,
you guys are successful. This isn't, you know what I
yes.
mean? It's not like,
yeah.
oh,
absolutely.
You know, you
absolutely.
Save a lot.
You know, a lot of what we do, I would say that, you know, most of our patients are pretty much some of the happiest patients in the hospital.
Nice.
And, you know, again, what we have is a good model, because the model is highly quality of life centered.
Nice.
We have excellent outcomes for the majority of our patients. And for those that have a sad outcome, mm-hmm. you know, we do everything that we can.
Yeah.
And, you know, as long as we have quality of life and their best interests at the top of the pyramid,
mm-hmm.
like I said, you really can't make a wrong choice. You know, you're not going to have 100% positive outcome all the time,
yeah.
but, you know, a lot of times we can get a very good outcome for them, far beyond what would have happened if we didn't treat.
That's so awesome.
I think what we do is we provide a service that's worthwhile, and you know, it's a fascinating job to have.
It's got to be. I mean, it's got to be, like, every day is a different day and different cases. And even if it's the same case, things that change. And, you know, you've got to be on your toes for this big time.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It's you never see the same thing.
Yeah, this
and
is
you
not
learn
the receptionist's job, you know.
Yeah, you learn something new every day. It's an education, a new education every single day you come through the door.
That's really cool. So do you think there's anything people can do to help prevent their pets from getting cancers, or that people, what they can do when their pet's being treated to help?
Sure. I think that doing one's research, you know, if they're going to look into a cat or a dog from a breeder, making mm-hmm. sure that the lines are sound, the breeding
wow.
lines are sound, and making sure that they ask the breeder about whether or not they've had cancer in the lines. You know, there are some breeders that do have cancer in their lines, and they will continue to breed because they breed really beautiful looking dogs and cats, but there is cancer in the lines. A conscientious breeder, once they have cancer in their lines, mm-hmm. they will retire
mm-hmm.
Those you know, the mother and the father, the breeding mm-hmm. animals that were responsible for that.
Wow.
So, you know, that's something to know. Shelter animals, rescue animals, you know, it's a little bit harder sometimes to know their history.
Yeah.
But in terms of screening, you know, mm-hmm. regular veterinary visits, mm-hmm. Regular screening, feeding a high-quality, balanced diet, mm-hmm. of which there are many now. You know, we're very lucky.
Oh, now it's a blessing.
Yeah, now there's a lot of choice, a lot of options, and general practitioners are very, you know, well-versed in, mm-hmm. in talking to people about diet and nutrition. A good supplement. I'm a huge fan of omega-3 fatty acids. Mm-hmm. They're anti-inflammatory. They're pro-immune system. They have been shown to have anti-cancer properties.
Cool.
So omega-3s are excellent.
Cool.
And then if, you know, we have a pet that does get cancer, just keeping everyone in the loop from their general practitioner. If they choose an oncologist, their oncologist.
Mm.
Some people choose alternative or holistic practitioners. They mm-hmm. look into acupuncture or alternative therapies. And I'm supportive of anything that we think may help.
Awesome.
So, you know, there's a host of options out there for people. You know, the healthcare professionals are out there,
mm-hmm.
and there are lots of different people to provide the support network. So
cool.
if people are looking for screening options and keeping their pets healthy, there's a host of people that have training in this and information
mm-hmm.
Aside from Dr. Google. So
are there any
which
sites?
Is not a bad thing, you know, I think it's important to, you know, go with people who have been trained.
Yeah, totally.
You know,
totally.
It's not bad to do one's own research, but I think it's always good to verify it with people who, you know, went to school and trained in these
well,
things
yeah.
because we're able to separate the wheat from the chaff.
Totally.
There's a lot of information out there and a lot of misinformation out there, and sometimes it can just get overwhelming
yeah.
for people.
Do you know, I should have called you about this and asked you beforehand, but do you know off the top of your head any sites that would be really good for, like, the layman to take a look and find out some information on cancer that's accurate and correct?
Yeah, so a lot of the university websites actually are really good. So
okay.
if you Google any of the vet school university websites,
okay.
Their cancer websites or their oncology departments, rather, will have a lot of times client-appropriate handouts
oh, nice.
That are kind of geared towards clients that are not overly technical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they provide good medical information, but they're not overly technical, and they'll talk about basic, you know, tenets of different cancers
mm-hmm.
and from screening to diagnosis to treatment options,
cool.
basic survival statistics. Actually, Memorial Sloan Kettering has an excellent search engine for herbal medicines.
I love them.
And for their patients, anyone can access it, but basically if you're on chemotherapy and you have, you know, an herbal medicine that you
mm-hmm.
want to try, you can kind of type in what herbal medicine you want to take, and it'll say this may interact with your chemotherapy in these different ways.
Wow.
It talks about all the properties of that herb, how
awesome.
It's supposed to be anti-cancer. So I direct a lot of my clients toward that website in particular because
cool.
it's very thorough, it's well researched, it's updated regularly.
Nice.
And for myself, who hasn't had necessarily formal training
mm-hmm.
in herbal medicines, you know, it's good for me to bone up on it and
totally.
Also make sure I'm giving my clients accurate information.
Totally.
So those types of things are good resources
makes
that are out on the
sense.
Web.
It makes total sense. So, yeah, if you're researching this or you're curious about this, really look at the source. And, I mean, that goes for anything when you're researching, especially medical. Like, look at your source, you know, and it might be some backyard person who's got a blog, and they might be right. But, like, if you can get to the pros, go to the pros first. And Sloan Kettering's amazing. They saved my life. They're great, great people. They know what they're doing. They have more information than you've ever cared to have, but it's there. So, you know, take advantage of the resources that are completely legitimate and people are making their lives or spending their lives doing this research. And, you know, it's not just
someone.
And we'll
help you.
Yeah.
You know, we'll help you give you internet sources that we think are well vetted, no pun intended, but it's a poor joke. But we will help with good resources. And, you know, I'm all for being educated. I have long discussions with my clients because I want them to be well educated.
Yeah.
I don't just want to be, you know, kind of maternalistic and say, this is what we're doing.
Yeah, and,
you
do know, this, and this.
This is the plan. And, you know, I think it's very important for everyone to be on the same page and also to know the reason behind what we're doing.
Totally.
But sometimes there's so much information out there that the message can get so confused.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I don't want people to question or kind of have a healthy debate or discussion. But sometimes there's just so much and it's just sort of, okay. Yeah. You know, let's just bring it back.
Yeah, totally.
So, yeah, we're always happy and willing to provide resources. And lots of times we have general practitioners call us up and have discussions, you know, when they're talking about cases with us.
Nice.
And even if the pet doesn't ever end up coming to see us, I'm more than happy to make myself available because that's what we're here for.
I think that's great. And this is why, I mean, I love Blue Pearl. And this is why the reason I have so many of you guys on this show is because you guys have this level of commitment and this really, you guys stick to your guns. And I really, really respect that. I mean, everyone I've had in here from Blue Pearl is like, you know what you're talking about, backwards, forwards, upside down, and sideways, which is already like, yay, you know. But then you guys also, like, you know, the things that you believe in, you really fully believe in them, and you follow behind them, and you're also, all you guys are more than willing to help out the general public and answer questions and things like that. So, yeah, if you guys are looking for referral services or something, check out Blue Pearl. I do love them. I'm being completely legit here. My pets go there all the time. But sadly, we are out of time, and this stinks because I could talk to you forever about this subject. I want to have you come back sometime if that's okay with you.
Sure. My Yay. Pleasure. I really appreciate you having me on, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much for sharing this information because it's not, you know, it's not a puppy and rainbow topic. And so it's something that I'm really grateful that you were able to come and we could, like, dispel some of the rumors and really talk about what's going on and look at it as a disease and not as, you know, cancer.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
It's a disease. We can manage it. And, you know, we do get a lot of good outcomes. So it's not all sadness. A lot of it is very, very positive. And I think is very rewarding.
Yay.
And we're very lucky to do what we do.
That's awesome.
So. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I will be back next week with a brand new episode. And until then, if you guys could like Heritage Radio Network on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, we'll see you next week.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.